She was told that it was safe to use, which therefore put her into the hospital. She was there for like 5 days. And she's also developed a chemical pneumonia.
I thought the water system was protected better than this. We need to protect our water system because this is going to hurt a lot of people.
As the water crisis in Flint continues, new challenges and victories for the environmental justice movement. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for March 31st, 2016. I'm Esther Avaram here on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital, where we are able to bring you coverage of social justice activists and activism. Well, this is our show of lasts. This is our last show on Thursday. Starting next week, we are moving to Fridays at 10 a.m., so mark your calendars and don't miss our Friday debut next Friday, April 8th at 10 a.m., On the Ground is on the move, but we'll still be covering activists and activism in the streets and in the suites of power here in D.C. and the DMV, and working with contributors to take your story of the week at 11 a.m., so continue to tune in. Also, this is the last day of Women's History Month, and our discussion today about the environmental assault on our communities will also be about how women are at the forefront of so many of these battles for sustainability, clean air, clean water, safe soil, safe food for our families and neighbors. Michelle Roberts, National Co-Chair of the Environmental Justice Health Alliance, is here to kick off this show's renewed commitment to cover issues of the environment and sustainability. And we'll be talking to her about one of our communities fighting a David versus Goliath battle against a corporate polluter and how they recently won a big victory. We'll also be talking about that and about how the lead poisoning crisis in Flint, Michigan is just the tip of the iceberg of not only deficiencies in the country's water infrastructure, but of structural environmental racism. So as always, we have a lot, maybe too much, packed into our less than an hour, starting with our headlines. The fourth and final nuclear summit of the Obama presidency is underway here in the nation's capital. Nuclear energy and nuclear weapons are not on the agenda, though both combined account for 98% of the world's supply of weapons-grade nuclear material. Also not on the agenda is the Obama plan to rebuild the U.S. nuclear arsenal at a cost of more than $1 trillion. Instead, most of the summit is focused on the threat of all the stockpiled nuclear material getting into the hands of terrorists. Preparing for the summit, the Nuclear Threat Initiative hosted a panel here on nuclear security in the Middle East. Chantel James has more.
In the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies, an event was held to discuss nuclear security in the Middle East. Speakers included Michelle Nalabandian of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, Nilsu Gorin of Turkey, El Said Edganem of Egypt, Ori Rabinovitz of Israel, and Farzan Sabed of Iran. Speakers talked about the nuclear security of their respective nations and suggested steps to move forward with greater transparency. Of note is the distinction between nuclear safety, which includes protecting citizens from the harmful effects of radiation, and nuclear security, which involves making sure that nuclear capabilities don't get into the hands of terrorists or other rogue actors. Chen Kane, Acting Director of the Middle East Nonproliferation Program and Senior Research Associate, explained why the summit chose to focus on nuclear security in the Middle East.
Since over 8 countries in the Middle East are seriously considering nuclear power plants, and 8 units are being right now constructed for the UAE, an additional 4 are in the plans right now for construction in Turkey, this is something that countries in the region should be aware of and think about.
Several of the countries represented ranked high on lists that denote that a country's nuclear security is being compromised, and speakers sought to address this. This is Chantal James for On the Ground, signing off.
As the summit winds up tomorrow, the organization Global Zero, that's globalzero.org, will rally to show world leaders that 15,000 ready-to-fire nuclear weapons in the world does not equal security, and that it's time to take action for a nuclear-free world. The rally will feature a life-sized inflated nuclear missile and Global Zero movement leaders. That's tomorrow, April 1st, noon, at McPherson Square at 15th and K Streets in Northwest. That's tomorrow noon, April 1st. Now, speaking of nuclear power, after the shocking decision by the D.C. Public Service Commission to allow the nuclear giant Exelon to take over Pepco, the Power D.C. Coalition is continuing the fight with a petition calling on Attorney General Carl Racine and the Office of the People's Counsel to challenge the Public Service Commission's erroneous decision. In addition, one of the coalition members, Grid 2.0, has filed a motion for the PSC to reconsider its decision. This automatically stays the commission's ruling, according to the coalition, and should the PSC reject this motion, which they expect it will, they will still have an opportunity to appeal through the court system. And they're at powerdc.org. Another huge organizing effort, Democracy Spring, starts this Saturday with a march from the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia to D.C., where from April 11th to the 18th, thousands have pledged to engage in civil disobedience and be arrested to demand that Congress take immediate action to end the corruption of big money in our politics and ensure free and fair elections in which every American has an equal voice. They have released a little video online about the organizing effort, Democracy Spring.
What separates Democracy Spring as a campaign, as an action, is really the fact that it will be historic. It's a movement of movements, right? So we have this overarching issue of money in politics, and that touches the immigration movement, the Black Lives Matter, racial justice movement, it touches climate policy, it touches all of these different issues that a lot of people working in silos can't necessarily come to an intersecting point on, right? So our opportunity right now is to create this umbrella for everyone working within those movements to come together, join together in unity, and acknowledge that we all have a common problem of big money in politics as a root cause of the issues and inequality we face, and to join in this historic threat action.
More information about the action is at democracyspring.org. Now, more than 100 groups representing 5 million Nigerians, comprising farmers, faith-based organizations, civil society groups, students, and local community groups, are vehemently opposing Monsanto's attempts to introduce genetically modified GM cotton and maize into Nigeria's food and farming systems. In written objections submitted to the biosafety regulators, the groups have cited numerous serious health and environmental concerns and the failure of these crops, especially GM cotton in Africa. And another bit of planet news, two beekeepers in Minnesota have received compensation from the state's Department of Agriculture after their hives were destroyed. The hives were severely damaged last spring by toxic pesticides that had drifted off a neighborhood cornfield. State officials have effectively confirmed what beekeepers have been saying for years. Quote, the most widely used class of insecticides in the world are acutely toxic to honeybees under routine circumstances, end quote. The finding is a landmark in the ongoing national fight over the controversial group of insecticides called neopentenoids, right? Okay. These chemicals have been implicated in the decline of bees and other wild pollinating insects across the U.S. The case marks the first government decision indicating that these pesticides are harmful to bees. On Capitol Hill, Congresswoman Maxine Waters introduced landmark legislation this week that would provide $13 billion to end homelessness in America. The legislation provides funding over 5 years to several programs and initiatives that will help the nearly 600,000 Americans who are currently homeless, one quarter of whom are children. The measure entitled the Ending Homelessness Act of 2016 is designed as an emergency relief bill that would provide immediate funding to address homelessness in America, targeting those areas where homelessness has reached crisis proportions. In Black Lives Matter news, Minneapolis police officers who shot and killed unarmed 24-year-old Jamar Clark will not face charges, prosecutors announced on yesterday. The Texas state trooper is seen on video harassing, bullying, and assaulting Sandra Bland during a false arrest last year, was just fired from his job. And here locally, progressive activists are winning some of their demands in their continuing fight for police reform in Maryland. Now, a few related culture and media items. Tonight there won't be a coup demonstration outside the Brazilian embassy at 3006 Massachusetts Avenue in Northwest. The Natural Living Expo, sponsored by Pathways Magazine, takes place this Sunday from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. at the College Park Marriott, with 150 exhibitors and 56 workshops. Black Millennials for Flint is holding a No Lead Zone Old School Pajama Jam on April 8th, starting at 10 p.m., and it's a fundraiser event bringing together African-American nonprofits and business owners, and it's going to be at the Spice Suite, 6902 4th Street in Northwest Washington, D.C. 100% of the proceeds will go to the Community Foundation of Greater Flint's Flint Child Health Development Fund. And, of course, in culture, Miles Ahead, the biopic about Miles Davis, starring Don Cheadle, opens tomorrow here in the DMV. And I just saw something last night also opening is the comedy called Meet the Blacks. So, and also tomorrow, the poetry anthology Resisting Arrest by poet Tony Medina drops tomorrow. And many poets, including myself, including in the book, will be reading from it in the weeks to come around the community. Now, to wrap up the headlines, Jamila Bay is here to talk about the elections. But before we do that, we need to tell listeners that you will actually be taking over this time slot beginning next week with your own show for Community Watch, Thursday's Community Watch and Comment. So tell us about the show, Jamila.
Thank you so much. This is the last Thursday we get to hang out and listen to me rant about government and rant about how absurd this 2016 presidential campaign season, the season that will never end, it feels like sometimes, has been. So it's been wonderful. But yeah, I get to come back in a week. And the show that I will be hosting is OMG with Jamila Bay. And OMG, of course, is Oh My Government, because mm-hmm. I don't know what else that would stand for. Mm-hmm. So I get to come back and hopefully make some sense out of what I have found to be senseless and foolish. And
hold people accountable.
Oh, right. Yeah, there we go. Yeah, hold people accountable and especially hold voters accountable, because there have always been voices of protest that said, you know, not voting is a protest, not participating is the way I choose to participate. But arguably, I would say the stakes have never been so high, and the wins that we talked about on this show, the wins in Cleveland, the wins in Chicago, ousting prosecutors. Texas seems to need a Buy Anita movement. Minneapolis seems to need a Buy Anita movement. Pittsburgh needs a Buy, anyway. So this is the stuff I'll be talking about on OMG as well. The conversations we've had on your show here have been poignant and meaningful, and I again have to say some of them have been absurd because we were speaking factually about what actually happened. We get to keep that thread going, you know, as the weeks go by and we get nearer to electing a president of this nation.
Wow. Okay. Well, so you wrapped up the what's happening in the election and our announcement all in one. So.
You know, yeah. And the point I really do want to make, and I just have to say this because I will explode if I don't. Donald Trump, who is better at media than most of the people covering him. Donald Trump, who really is the candidate who, see, this is what happens when you don't make your kids read Orwell. And if you did not read Being There, Jerry Kaczynski, you would not understand how we got to Trump today. Trump is like, la, 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 I think I'm going to run for president. Oh, boy, they taking me seriously now. Uh-oh, I might win this thing. What now? And he's just saying absurdity upon absurdity upon absurdity. And the thing he said yesterday that needs to make everybody understand that their vote matters and that their voice matters and that their bodies matter is that according to Donald Trump, women who have had abortions should suffer some punishment for having done so. You know,
no, you don't have to go any further.
Foolishness. Foolishness. Abortion is a medical procedure. There are times where a patient and a doctor decide that that is the best medical procedure for a patient to have. And unless you are my doctor, unless you are me, it's none of your business what medical procedures I choose to have. But I'm sure he'll go back to making fun of Ted Cruz's wife now or something. I don't know. Anyhow, thank you for having had me so many, many weeks. This is great. And Friday mornings at 10, everybody will be tuned.
Yes, I will be moving to Fridays at 10, as I mentioned, and we'll be staying on to help, some of our volunteers and contributors take listeners' story of the week. So we'll have a chance to still talk to listeners, which I really enjoy very much. So those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, why Flint, Michigan is just the tip of the iceberg. Stay with us. We gonna be all right. And welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Rivera. Well, as we mentioned in the headlines, in D.C. today, leaders from dozens of nations are gathered here to discuss the terror threats of nuclear material. Yet our own communities, like Flint, are directly impacted by chemical and pollution threats and dangers daily. With me today to discuss this crisis is Michelle Roberts, National Co-Chair of the Environmental Justice Health Alliance, a national environmental justice grassroots network of groups around the United States working for communities and populations that are disproportionately impacted by toxic chemical exposure. Welcome to On the Ground, Michelle.
Thank you, Esther. It's a joy to be here.
And, well, I should say that today's discussion, I hope, and I'm sure will be the first of a regular series highlighting environmental justice issues with you. Now, since this atrocity in Flint came to light, there have been several reports that, like we just said, Flint is just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the deteriorating plumbing and toxic water. So what have your studies and work on the ground told you about it being just the tip of the iceberg?
True. You know, you just spoke about the issues with the bees and pesticides and what have you. A couple of years ago, just about 3 years ago, this time in April 2013, there was an explosion in West Texas, and it was the result of a fertilizer plant explosion. Fertilizer plant that was storing huge amounts of ammonium nitrate. And in that community, many people didn't even know that they were storing that that high level of toxicity. There were three schools actually located within a mile of that facility, and it was a good thing that it happened, they said, in the evening. Should it have happened during the day, those schools would have been impacted, elementary schools, and the bulk of those children were children of color. The work that we have done through the Environmental Justice Health Alliance, we authored, I'm one of the co-authors of the demographic analysis, a recent demographic analysis that kind of mirrored that of toxic waste and race, if you will. But only this one comes from the voice of grassroots and those advocates who are working with them. We found in this demographic analysis that 134 million Americans are living in danger zones that are around 3,433 facilities that EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, identifies as risk based facilities. So these facilities have the capacity of impacting populations to the degree of actually wiping them out, if you will.
Wow. So the EPA has recognized these facilities as being a danger. So what does the EPA do about it?
It's a funny thing. We do have regulations under the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, but the problem is that not all of the regulations under both of those acts that, by the way, were created 40 years ago, have not been fully implemented. So therefore, we are finding more and more that communities of color, specifically Black, then Latino, in that order, as we found in this demographic analysis, are actually the canaries in the minefield, living fence line. As many would say, the magic fence is what is supposed to protect them from that of terror. But these folks are living in stress-related communities daily, not knowing whether these plants will explode or not.
Now, in addition to this recent study, the environmental justice movement won an important victory. And I want you to tell us a little bit of, more about that. What I do know is that the EPA will put in place new safeguards to help protect communities from dangerous chemical spills at tens of thousands of these industrial facilities nationwide. And these were the terms of a legal settlement approved by the Federal District Court in New York. And the agreement is meant to strengthen protections as called for by Congress more than four decades ago, as you mentioned. So I guess it seems like double-edged. I'm glad that you won this court fight, but why did you have to refight it if this was put in place four decades ago? How come the EPA hasn't been implementing and putting into place these rules?
Absolutely, Esther. You know, first of all, this is one of the reasons why the environmental justice movement, if you will, was formed decades ago, because of the fact that people had to take their own destinies into their hands. This, as you said, this actual regulation should have been implemented 40 years ago. It impacts those facilities. They are above ground storage tanks that are located in mostly rural areas, but in urban areas as well, that can impact water supply. And situation of a case in point, the Charleston, West Virginia water contamination crisis that occurred in 2014, January of 2014. We found that this could have been avoided had regulations been put in place to protect the public water supply. What's important to know is that this particular facility, this above ground storage tank, actually was not considered a risk tank, that risk-based storage facility, as was that of the one in West Texas. But the hypocrisy to this is that it co-opted over 300,000 people's ability to have access to clean and safe drinking water. And on the heels of that, this particular industry went bankrupt.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about West Virginia very much in depth in the second half. We'll actually have one of the activists on the ground who was very instrumental in getting justice for that community. So we look forward to that.
Sure.
But in the meantime, I'm kind of wrapping this into our discussion about Flint. It's almost common wisdom right now to point to infrastructure as the problem in Flint. And nationally, you know, there are people talking about how much it will cost to replace pipes there and in other communities that have these aging, deteriorated pipes. But you say that this crisis also reflects structural racism.
Absolutely.
So tell us more about that.
Absolutely. When we find more and more the studies that show who's actually disproportionately impacted by these the fact that these rules have not been implemented, policies have not been fully addressed, or that of enforcement being fully handled. Time and time again, we are finding on the other end of that is people of color. And in many of these some of these communities are unincorporated communities. Others are poor communities. As we are even talking about the new big energy regime, they are becoming the dumping grounds yet again for long-term storage of hazardous waste. It's targeted time and time again. And then if we talk about relocating these communities, some will say, oh, well, it's like Aaron Brockovich. But as we say in the environmental justice movement, Aaron Brockovich walks away with a movie, while many people of color, like communities in Mossville, Louisiana, and others, walk away with a potential mortgage and lose their rights to their land, their culture, their health, their minerals that they may own, and so on and so forth. So we have what's called the debt to nature land swap right here in America. We have right here in America the global South here in the North, if you will.
So explain to us what debt to nature swap, what does that mean, and also that other term you used.
The debt to nature land swap is when we have these big, well-intended non-governmental organizations and countries at time going into countries, into Latin America, Central America, Africa, and other spaces, saying that we will take care, if you will, of your resources because you may not have the capacity and the will to do so. And as a result, they are selling out the land and resources for profit to big industrialized corporations, and thereby leaving these countries poor with huge debts, severe health crisis, as we see droughts and floodings and all of these other things, such as you mentioned earlier on when we talked about the crisis with the bees, when we hear about the floodings in Africa and Latin America and other spaces, the deforestation of forests and what have you.
So are there any local, and I know we didn't talk about this before, so I hope I'm not asking you something that's like totally like on the moon or something, but how about locally? I know that at a few environmental rallies we've covered here on the show, there have been people talking about Prince George's County and the effort or plan to perhaps build some new incinerators that will impact our communities here locally. But are there any local issues that you can point to that people can kind of relate to here in the DMV?
Absolutely. We can look right down the street in Ivy City. Right in Ivy City. We are right in Washington, no doubt. We talk about the water in Flint, but has anyone spoke to the crisis of the water right here in Washington, D.C.?
Right.
Has anyone asked about the water that the children are drinking in Ivy City, or the bus depots proposed in Ivy City? So we have local crisis right here. The watershed in Anacostia, as you spoke about what Exelon's plans are. All of those are environmental injustices.
Okay. And I know this year also marks another important victory, the executive order on environmental racism, which I think is a little different from the other anniversary in terms of the initial recognition of these dangers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. It was in the early 90s that people of color, again, as we said, thousands of people of color came to Washington, D.C., no doubt, to speak to the issues that were impacting where they live, where they play, where they pray, where they go to school, where they worship, because of the many who were losing their lives and their health due to the disproportionate toxics and contaminations in their communities. That was a movement that pushed then President Clinton to author an executive order with respect to addressing federal agencies across the board to address that of environmental justice. Since that time, people have continued to push. We are now pushing, let me take a step back and say that when these communities came to Washington, it was not just laying the various issues of their community on the table, but also they had solutions, and the solutions were that we needed a more just and just transition. We needed to be able to transition off of fossil fuels and have a much more holistic and sustainable way at looking at our chemicals management portfolio and addressing how it is we deal with oil and gas. And so as a result of that, they early on spoke to the issues of the climate crisis that we're now experiencing today. With that came the executive order 12898 that spoke to that of environmental justice. Again, the devil's in the details, because anything with justice that is addressing people of color, especially, and as we heard earlier with the political climate on race and racism and what you heard with the shooting, we must continue to press for justice, and that's what communities are doing today.
Okay. I have a lot more questions about West Virginia in particular, and we're going to get to that in the second half. And Michelle Roberts will be staying with me, and we'll be also talking to one of the community activists on the ground in West Virginia. Stay with us.
In the 20th century, we understood that environment has an effect on public health.
The future that scientists have warned us about has arrived.
Here's the simple truth.
The problems we face did not come down from the heavens. They are made by bad human decisions.
But the corrosive elements in Flint, Michigan's water source help deteriorate pipes and send lead into the drinking system.
Breaking news out of North Korea once again, where Pyongyang is now threatening a nuclear strike.
ISIS just claimed a major new terror attack in the Belgian capital of Brussels.
Well, I'd immediately strengthen our borders.
EPR came to Kim Jong-un as his country conducted a hydrogen bomb test as a self-defense test against the United States and the threat of nuclear war.
I think that you brought up the Trump and Bernie. And generally, Trump is doing a version of what Republicans always do, which is to say that the problems in your life are caused by people outside of this country. Scary brown and black people from all around the world, yellow people, they're all scary, and they're going to come in, they're going to take all our jobs, they're going to invade us, they're going to blow us up and all that.
Let's make America great again.
That was Mercy, Mercy Me, the Ecology remix by DJ Waheed here on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram here with Michelle Roberts, National Co-Chair of the Environmental Justice Health Alliance. In the first half, we opened up this discussion on environmental racism and environmental justice. And in this half, we're discussing one particular community and a particular victory for the environmental justice community. In 2014, communities in West Virginia's Kanawha Valley experienced firsthand a major hazardous chemical spill when more than 10,000 gallons of a chemical used to clean coal leaked from a storage facility into the Elk River, just upstream from a large water treatment plant that supplies Charleston its drinking water. The contamination deprived nearly 300,000 citizens of access to clean tap water for a week. Little discussed was how this chemical spill greatly impacted a historically black legacy community and the struggle of that community to fight back. So joining us for this segment is Pam Nixon, president of People Concerned About Chemical Safety, located in Charleston, West Virginia. She retired from the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection in 2014 after 15 years as the environmental advocate. Before DEP, Nixon was technical consultant for CarePoint Physicians, Inc. of Dunbar, West Virginia, and a medical technologist in the clinical laboratory at St. Francis Hospital in Charleston. She's a member of the Kanawha Putman Emergency Planning Committee, thank you. She's on the board of directors for the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition located in Huntington, West Virginia, and People Concerned About Chemical Safety, as I mentioned. She was appointed to the Public Water System Supply Study Commission by Governor Earl Tomlin in 2014. Good morning, Pam. I hope it's okay if I call you Pam.
Yes, it is.
Okay, welcome to the show. So we were talking earlier in the show about an overview of the environmental justice issues in the country, but I wanted to tell us about your story about what happened in your community.
In Institute, that community has what is known as a large chemical complex that's located down there, and back in the mid 1980s, it was the group People Concerned About Chemical Safety was first called People Concerned About MIC. MIC was a chemical that killed the thousands of people in Bhopal, India, and it was also being manufactured and stored and transported through the community of Institute.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And a lot of people may not realize that because at the time, that was a really huge global story. What happened in Bhopal, India, and many people killed by this product produced by Union Carbide. So what happened in 2014 wasn't the first time that the community had faced this type of pollution and environmental threat.
No, it wasn't the first time. There had been a series of incidences that had occurred over the years to the people in Institute.
Okay. And so what has been the role of the EPA in terms of helping the community, addressing this threat to the community?
Go ahead.
And I was just wondering, were they helpful during this time? And, you know, I know the environmental justice movement was just kind of getting started so that people could fight back. But in the meantime, did the federal government do anything to help?
In which incident? In the 20?
Yes, I mean, yeah, in the beginnings of the, you know, after the first leak of this chemical, I guess you're talking about like maybe in the 80s or early 90s.
Oh, okay. In the mid 80s, there were no community right to know laws, and so federal government had to develop the Sarah Title, had to develop Sarah Title III community right to know law, so that the community of Institute and other communities across the country would be able to know what was actually being produced and in their neighborhoods and being transported out of their neighborhoods and being released into the air, water, and on their land.
Wow. So before that, people didn't even know.
That's true.
Right. And so when people found out, when did people find out basically what was being produced right next door to them, and how did the community react?
The community right to know laws actually went into effect around 1986. And it was after that time that the companies had to release all of had to actually provide this information to the communities so that we would be able to have conversations about what was going on in our community.
Now, I know that the many of the environmentalists I've spoken to on this show have used the term sacrifice zone. Is that, you know, in terms of taking the long view, is this what we're talking about? Are so many of our communities just been considered sacrifice zones, not only by corporations, but by these regulatory agencies?
We feel as though we have been considered sacrifice zones. Because once one company has a permit to manufacture something or build a facility in a community, then that actually zones that community as a manufacturing zone. And so that community reaps does not reap any benefits. It reaps all of the ill effects from the company. And in Institute, we were so close to the company, we knew we were at ground zero. And that's what we always called it. We were at ground zero. And in the planning phase through the emergency planning committee, they talked about the sheltering in place because it would be difficult to actually evacuate anybody out of that community. And the community people always felt that if we were sheltering in place, then in our homes, then they would have our addresses, and should anything catastrophic happened to us, they would know who we were because we were in our homes at those addresses.
Wow.
And we considered ourselves a sacrifice.
Wow. Now, I have a clip of a few folks talking about the 2014 spill, the immediate aftermath of that. Mm-hmm. We'll go to that clip now.
If it wasn't for the emergency places, like, that were handing out waters at the Winfield Courthouse and stuff, then I wouldn't have any water. Nobody knew about it, really, unless they had TV, and I don't even have TV. So, because we don't watch television. So, and that was difficult, because we'd already taken showers in it and drank the water and all that.
My daughter became seriously ill after using this water before she was told that it was safe to use, which therefore put her into the hospital. She was there for like 5 days. She's also developed a chemical pneumonia.
I thought the water system was protected better than mass. I mean, we need to protect our water system because this is going to hurt a lot of people.
Yeah, those were voices from a video called West Virginia Water Crisis by Krista Bryson. She's from West Virginia, but now she lives in Oklahoma City, and she posted that on her blog online. Now, I guess in reaction to this most recent crisis, I'm wondering about, I want to get your reaction to this latest news about the legal settlement to protect communities. And I guess it came about just in the recent weeks. And do you think that this settlement will actually, how will it impact your community, and how will it help communities are already polluted or threatened by pollution?
I'm not quite sure what settlement it is that you're talking about.
Oh, okay. You know, maybe I should direct this question to Michelle Roberts. She's here with me in the studio, and she was telling me about the settlement. So how will this settlement actually help communities like in those in West Virginia and around the country?
Yeah, with this settlement, this will help us to be able to really identify those triggers that would place water systems in harm's way. It will address at least about 350 chemicals We're looking at tens of thousands of communities who have these storage, these above ground storage tanks, if you will, in their backyards that could co-opt their water systems. We're also looking at, with this particular rule, it will also force the government to come onto the ground in West Virginia to actually review the full crisis, because the government has, the federal government has really not fully been on the ground in West Virginia since the contamination to fully address the issue, because mostly of the politics there on the ground with the local West state of West Virginia, if you will. It will also be a with this ruling, and they must, they being the federal government, must begin working on this rule right now. So as we speak right now, they must be working on it and have it complete within 3.5 years. It should be fully implemented. And with that, hoping to be able to really make sure that water systems are better protected from harm, and that there are regulations in place to make sure that these facilities are not co-opting the health and well-being of local schools, communities, residences, churches, what have you.
So is there funding attached to the settlement so that there are actually resources to implement it? And what kind of accountability standards are there in terms of making sure it's actually implemented?
Well, first of all, we have a consent decree from the federal courts that said that this must take place. So we have, with this consent decree, based on our attorneys at the Natural Resource Defense Council, we can take them back to court to make sure that this is is fully implemented. Funds must fully be attached to this. Again, this is a 40-year, this has been four decades that the government has failed to put these rules in place. And so therefore, they must have the funding associated with it. All of that must be addressed in this particular rulemaking piece.
Okay, I want to ask both of you about how these environmental issues, well, if these environmental issues are, how they're integrated into the concerns about climate change, if they're integrated into this larger climate movement, or if they're kind of considered separately from what is, you know, arguably a larger movement and a wider movement for climate change.
Well, you know, one of the things that we pushed, Esther, especially in writing the Who's in Danger, Race, Poverty, and Chemical Disasters, we were very mindful of all of the threats to our dearly beloved Mother Earth that actually forces the issue of the climate crisis. So we were very intentional in writing that document, with even that of the solutions that we offered with respect to that. Now, some would say, well, this is addressing chemical disaster and responses to disasters. But we would argue that, first of all, our chemicals management policies are deeply flawed and deeply broken. So we took what was the most egregious, and we looked across the board at the egregious scenarios of the extractive industry, of the chemicals management system, of the oil and gas regime, if you will. And what would that look like to flip it on its head, to take a more precautionary standpoint as opposed to the risk base standpoint that our government operates under right now. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and all of its well intentions, unfortunately operates on a risk-based regime. What does that mean? That means a certain number of people are okay to be at risk. And that has to stop. And so if we are able to flip that narrative and the thought process of how our regulatory process is actually framed, then we can address the climate crisis. But only until our communities feel, especially given they are right there fence line to this, only until we address it in that way, we will be creating a crisis to our dear Mother Earth. And it will be a climate crisis. It will be more storms and what have you. And so that's why we're calling for this radical change.
Right. Pam, did you want to add to that?
Yes. When we look at climate change, we are going to be, you know, people are going to be dislocated. And the ones that are going to be most impacted are going to be the low income and minority communities. Mm-hmm. When it comes to climate change, though, they're the ones that don't have the clout or the influence and don't have the money actually to be able to move away from these issues when they occur, such as the flooding or whatever that will occur as a result of the climate change.
Yes. You know, when you were speaking, Michelle, it reminded me of going back almost full circle to Flint, because you talked about how the chemical management system is broken. And I think a lot of people would consider that a federal task. But when you look at what people consider to be maybe a politicized approach to Flint right now, and what the federal government is doing or not doing, it just reminds me of the fact that when this crisis occurred in West Virginia, there was no real federal assistance. One of the specialists called in to help the people of Flint told the governor that, well, you know, in the future, everyone's going to have to look to you to see how you handle this, because no one else will know what to do. And he basically said that the federal government had not come in to help what should have been like an emergency. So there seems to be a disjoint between local emergencies like this and what is the responsibility of the state and what is the responsibility of the federal government.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that we're calling for in the Who's in Danger work, as well as what President Obama has called for in the Executive Order 13650, Improving Chemical Safety and Facilities. We're pushing for better integration of local emergency planning commissions, making sure that communities have the right to know that they are fully engaged in what the evacuation process looks like, that they are fully engaged in the response. The sad note is, with respect to Charleston, West Virginia, I found out we contacted the community there in Charleston, West Virginia by Facebook. Facebook. We find out that this crisis had happened. I happened to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the time, and we reached out to the folks in West Virginia. We had to take the folks from West Virginia to the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council, which is a council that speaks to EPA, to even try to push EPA to do something about it because of the politics, the local and federal politics, if you will.
Wow. I thank both of you. I've been speaking with environmental justice activists Michelle Rogers and Pam Nixon. I've run out of time, but thank you so much for joining me this morning on the ground.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you, Esther.
And that will do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Avaram, and I had Jamila Bay with me for the last time here on Thursday. Remember, she will be your new host on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment for OMG, Oh My Government. Please stay tuned and support her, and check me out in my new time slot, Fridays at 10 a.m. for On the Ground. Also, special thanks to our guest environmental activists, Michelle Rogers and Pam Nixon. Again, thanks Chantel James for her reporting at the Nuclear Security in the Middle East program. Thanks to Lydia Curtis, Michael Byfield, DJ Wahid, and thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening on Thursdays for the past 2 years. Don't forget to move with us to Friday, 10 a.m. starting next week. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace. Bye.